Hello, and welcome back to the Heart Gallery podcast. I'm Rebecca Rivel, the Kremer, and it is so good to be back recording. If you're interested in the podcast schedule and understanding a little bit about why it's been so long since I have put out an episode, listen to the end of this one. I share more about all of that there. But for today, we are talking about the climate crisis. And if you've been here before, you know that climate change comes up a lot in these episodes. We've had artists on the podcast talking about how to make climate change more concrete for individuals and specific communities. And I'm thinking about Elisa Petrosova, who did a fantastic job in her episode, and also Justin Cook very recently. We also talk about how climate can be communicated through the lens of different species. And this one's very interesting because I think by showing the experience of non-human creatures, we can create this sideways door into the climate crisis where people are maybe brought in through curiosity, which in turn unlocks a deeper care for specific species or specific ecosystems, which then in turn leads to greater interest and awareness about climate change. And so many people have talked about this, like Taylor Friis-Solo-Reese is a great example, Rohan Chakravarti, Christy Belcourt, John Cager, and so many others touch on this, right? But those are the big ones. And the guest today is Tara Deport. She is an artist working in primarily in climate spaces. I'm referring to the spaces where people are working on climate action, quote unquote climate action, climate adaptation, climate policy, often higher level spaces like NGOs, governmental organizations, for example, the United Nations, where you have people talking at this like very sort of like high level that can feel like very inaccessible because it's like quite dry and has a lot of barriers to entry for most people. And she comes from this world. I also have spent some of my professional life in these spaces. And it's really nice to find someone else who has been trying to bring creativity into spaces where you maybe wouldn't think that they're the most art inclined. Tara has a really interesting art background, which she'll talk about. But I just wanted to make a note that it's super interesting to talk to someone who is trying to do something similar to me. Like, I don't often get a chance to compare notes with others, and maybe I'm not reaching out in the most effective way possible, but it was just very cool to have this conversation, and it makes me excited to have more conversations with people who are trying to bring more creative approaches into less creative spaces. So Tara is just so clear-sighted about the challenges of climate communication and climate art, like what climate art can actually do and how it can actually be wielded by the communities that are at the front lines of the climate crisis. I love talking to her, and I had this conversation a little while ago, and I've been thinking a lot about her ideas and advice since we talked. Tara, I had shared with you a question outline by email, and then this morning I was on a walk with my husband and my baby and dog, and I was thinking about like the core of what I want to get to with you today. And I actually haven't recorded a podcast in a little while. This is episode 16 of the Heart Gallery, and I had uploaded a number of them before the new year, and then I was taking a little intentional break just to think about how things were going. And during that break, I realized that what I really want to get to with guests is imagination, is to explore the types of futures that people are working towards. I have this privilege of talking to so many artists and creators, but also curators, also people who have multiple roles, like we were talking about before we started the conversation recording. And that's what I'm really interested in, is like, what kind of future are people trying to build towards? I think you and I both know, like working in the climate space, that it can be very easy to be in rooms, be in communities, be in conversations, like where it can feel quite heavy, right? Like we have a lot of heavy information coming towards us. Like if you're steeped in the data, if you're steeped in the research, if you're seeing what's happening in frontline communities, it can be easy to be in that space. But you are an artist and you're working on a lot of creative endeavors and you work with a lot of creative people and you work in storytelling. And so I wonder, to start off, and then we can sort of work backwards from there, I'm wondering if you can share, what are you trying to build towards in the world?
That's a great question. And I love starting with that because I feel like that's often like the action items or the goals are often at the end of any story, like a film we watch that inspires us. Then there's like a 3-minute clip of what you can do with all of this emotion, inspiration, et cetera. So thanks for starting with that. For me, and also, you know, as core to the mission of the Human Impacts Institute, it's working towards a world that is more centered on justice and equity across cultures, within communities, that it's about improving access to natural resources and basic needs, and to also supporting the dignity of communities, which I think is a huge aspect of that as well. So it's not only the list of things we learn, many of us learn in kindergarten that we need to survive, you need food, water, shelter, et cetera, but also this aspect of dignity is so important, and that's, you know, also defined by ourselves and our culture and our community. That's the large picture. If I were to dive in deeper and get more specific, it's a future that is not based on extraction. It's not based on the extraction of fossil fuels, the extraction of human resources in terms of production and consumption, but really this idea of regeneration, which I love as a word, of that's what happens in nature. Our systems are cyclical on our planet. And for some reason, as a species, we've decided to create social systems that are not cyclical, that don't work with the world and the constraints we actually live within, which is why we see so much of this destruction of our planet, of other species, and of our communities. So I think this idea of recreating our social systems, which includes our economic systems, our way of doing business, our way of relating to one another, that are about giving back to each other and to the planet, and really thriving. I think one of the biggest reasons why I started HII is this concept of we need to help people dream what's possible, and not just think about what is. We need to create new, you know, or recreate old as well. It's not that, you know, all of the good ideas are in the future. There are many that are currently exist, or that are from ancient cultures, et cetera.
Right now, I just want to work backwards, like I said, and have you just share a little bit more about what the Human Impacts Institute is, how it came about.
Sure. So we are an international nonprofit organization, or NGO, as some groups call it. We were founded in New York City by me when I was a longtime New Yorker. And really, our mission is to use arts and culture to inspire big, bold, and beautiful climate action. And where it came about was from a lot of my own personal experience, both as a visual and performing artist, but also as an environmental educator and someone working in climate policy and communications, where in all of these different worlds, I was seeing kind of this triangle of facts that wasn't connecting. It was kind of, you know, I'm visually showing a triangle that's not touching, where we know what the problem is. The vast majority now, you know, in 2024, knows what is happening. We know there are lots of solutions that exist, you know, everything from technology to systems change to grassroots initiatives. You know, there's so much out there. There's policy, et cetera. And we actually know now that most people do care. They have different reasons for caring, for engaging, et cetera. It might not be about climate change. It might not, you know, it might be about economy. It might be about justice. It might be about real estate prices. It might be about a million different things, but a lot of people care. But we're not nearly doing enough. You know, we're hitting no targets that we've set. So the idea of the Human Impacts Institute was like, we need more people to experiment and to get creative on how we connect those three things together. And who are the people that inspire us in our world and in our lives? It's the creatives, it's the artists, it's the storytellers that know how to really reach us on the emotional and the intellectual level, you know, that gets through the data to really touching us and touching who we are.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, welcome to the podcast. I've been so lucky to talk to so many people who think along those lines and are trying to come at that in various ways. And I wonder if you can share then, I don't know, 2-3 little tiny snapshots of what that looks like. How are you bringing that experimentation into communities?
Well, I have 2 that are right on the front of my mind because I've been working on them a lot the last few days. I'm really, really proud that we just launched a 4-month fellowship for young people from around the world yesterday called Artivism and Amplifiers. And we had over 90 applicants from around the world, and we selected 35 from 25 different countries in the global North and South. It's simultaneously happening in English, French, and Spanish. So access certainly is a huge part of justice, is language and access via language. And it's a journey together of really building their network, sharing our privilege as a mostly global North, many urban, higher income, many white-led organization to share and open doors to these young activists and leaders from around the world. So every week we come together and they meet and exchange with new experts around climate communication, science and policy, activism, community engagement, and then they'll be working together to develop creative projects, films, podcasts. So we might be talking with you later about that one, graphic design series, et cetera, that we will be exhibiting for a Creative Climate Awards Festival in New York City. That leads me to the second program, Creative Climate Awards, which is one of our first programs. So it's 13 years old now. I think this is our 13th year. And it's a month-long festival celebrating artists and creatives from around the world that are tackling climate change in their work. We have an open call every year. This year's themes is Solutions from the Front Lines. And for the second year, we are projecting the entire exhibit along with climate demands on the Manhattan Bridge with the City of New York.
It's incredible.
And yeah, it's so exciting, among many other things. So those are 2 different examples of both capacity building and supporting the leaders that are around the world doing this work and are young and energetic and bringing new voices to it, and then also celebrating the art and engaging through that way. I think a third one that I'm really excited about is actually a new program called the Creative Climate Communications Lab.
CCC.
C3 Lab. Yeah, we decided it rolls off the tongue, you know. And I'm really excited about this because this is kind of a new concept for us in the last couple of years, this lab concept, which is to also connect researchers to this. So to not only have the creatives and the artists, but the people that are the experts and the solutions of all types, but to also then bring in ones that are actually understanding and doing the deep dive into the research, the trends, et cetera. So that's a really exciting collaboration that we're launching in Brooklyn this year with the support of the state of New York.
That's fantastic. And I have some follow-up questions. I'm wondering, so as you were starting to speak, I was thinking about who you're trying to reach, and I'm sure it varies across your different projects and programs and the lab. But then you mentioned the bridge, and of course, that's very public-facing. Yeah. And I know that you have a number of other projects that you've run that are very much sharing information broadly with the public. I'm thinking specifically of this great campaign you had around posters with climate heroes that I think were deployed all over New York City. So can you talk a little bit about who you're trying to reach with your programming typically?
Sure. That's a great question. And that's always hard, I think, in our work because we're like, we need everybody. But also the best communication. And as a group working on climate communications, of course, is specialized. So my first answer to that would be people that are already engaged. So we're not trying to change minds necessarily as an organization. Of course, if we do happen to change minds along the way, great. But there's so many people that do care, that are engaged, but don't know what to do, feel lost, or feel like they're not doing enough, or they want to act locally, or they don't see themselves in the movement because they've never seen someone that looks like them or talks like them in the movement. So that is, I think, our audience. It tends to be more urban. because that's just where a lot of our community is. But in the past couple of years, that has changed drastically. But actually, the past 2 years, we were approached to work with a coalition of Indigenous leaders from 400 communities from the Global South. And poof, there goes the urban focus. So we really curtail our programs to who wants to work and collaborate with us. So even though some programs repeat, we change them, adapt them every time, which is the basis of creativity. We need to adapt and create and experiment and fail.
Yeah, I appreciate that so much. The focus on audiences or participants who want to be engaged or maybe don't even know that they want to be engaged, but will be willing to be engaged if they were given a hint of what that engagement could be. I think you're so spot on with that focus. And I think like being a person who's on social media and who shares art on social media and who has a pretty creative community online, I think I see that that's something that a lot of people are struggling with right now. I think a lot of artists who I interact with are wondering, like, how can I do something more meaningful that connects more to the issues that are happening on the ground? You know, there's a lot of like sharing and appreciating that happens online, but like how that gets taken away from that space is a question that I think about quite a bit. And I feel lucky to get to work with the Red Cross, Red Crescent Climate Center, and other humanitarian and climate organizations, where I feel like I do get a little bit of that like real world trying and failing of ideas. But I'm wondering if you can share for people who might be listening, who are creative, who are artists, who do want to engage and maybe are engaged online, some ideas for how they can get engaged in their communities.
I love that question. Well, the first is I like to challenge creatives to think about in their work and what they're communicating is how often are they focusing on the problems and how often are they focusing on what we can do. And having had thousands of submissions to our Creative Climate Awards over the years from around the world, I have a pretty good idea of what the answer would be is that mostly it's about the problem. Which, of course, we need to talk about. We need to make it personal to our communities, for our communities. But I like to challenge creatives, including myself, like, how do we make people dream about what's possible? And I think that's the real challenge, is not just about being like, oh my God, we have to do something, but what? That question you started with. So that would be the first part, is to really think of how you can do that and connect with that what in your community. Make it local. Make it personal. Who are the amazing people and organizations and community initiatives that are happening in your circle? Because that's also where you have the most influence, where you probably have the most cultural relativity as well in terms of your work. And so those would be two big ones. And then that is something that we're thinking about in the coming years is to have more and more capacity training for creatives, both around understanding the complexity of communicating climate issues, because it's not an easy topic to communicate when you have a goal in mind for your communication, and helping them connect more with community groups. You know, what does it mean to have an artistic practice that includes community engagement? Because that's not evident. I know my process, if I wasn't pushed by the work I do, is like being in my studio painting by myself with no one talking to me. Like that's my process. So yeah, those would be some of the challenges and maybe advice that I would give to creatives.
Tara, that's so interesting. You say that you would be like locked away in your studio, because that brings me to another question I had specifically about your art practice. And I would wonder if that's actually true, because from what I can tell, you came from an art background. You have an education in art and you figured out over time like how to weave these issues into your practice. But before you were even weaving these spaces together, you were exploring subjects of interconnectedness amongst individuals and communities and the environment and other global issues within your practice. Is that right? Can you talk about your practice and how you came to be an artist who's out in the world? Or were you in fact already an artist who was always integrated into the surroundings?
Thank you. Thank you for calling me out too. Maybe I just want to be in my studio right now. I actually am in my studio. No one knows, but I am. So Yes, actually, I do have an arts background as well as a climate science and policy background. So as maybe you've heard in some other interviews, as a seven-year-old, I was writing to my congressperson in Washington, D.C. to save the planet and starting a club and making all of my friends donate to Greenpeace or their parents donate
so
to
cool.
Greenpeace.
Wait, and why? Why were you doing that? It's so cool.
I don't know. I was just, my parents are supportive, but they're not.
Yeah.
They were environmentalists. They were, it just, all my t-shirts.
You don't know?
No, it just, that's, it's like I was born that way. I was also doing art competitions and like protesting the tank farm next to our townhouse in Fairfax, Virginia, like at 10 years old. But I know I answered the door as a young person and there was like someone asking for donations from the Greenpeace Activist Network. And I think I talked to them for an hour. But I already had all of my t-shirts were like Save the Bay and, you know, some form of like environmental action. So I just seem to be made as an artist and environmentalist. I think I just have always felt this just awe and respect for the earth and nature and how we exist. I'm not religious and I wasn't raised religious, and maybe it came from that, that it's like I get that inspiration, that awe, that magic from looking around me. So coming back to your question, I guess, is, I mean, I talk in my art, it's always been, I talk about what's on my mind, what's happening in my life, whether it's, you know, an experience, you know, when I travel, I often do a series about the experience I'm having in that culture. Becoming a mother. I've certainly done a lot about womanhood and motherhood and relationships. And I've done a lot of installation and performance work too, which is not as public. So I guess I am out in the public. I can say in a vulnerable way that really combining my creative art practice with the sustainability work scared me a lot because I felt like as a creative, I could be, you know, respected as an artist in that world. And as, you know, someone doing policy at the UN or doing, you know, teaching education classes in New York, et cetera, I could be respected in those worlds. But I had to put those hats on. And that if I changed hats, you know, if I wore my art hat in there and was covered in paint or doing a weird performance, my legitimacy, particularly as a woman, as a young woman at the time, not now, but as a young woman, would go out the window. So it was scary. It was really scary to bring my own creative practice into this work, into HII. But I also, after starting HII, when I was challenging everyone else to do it, I was like, I am a hypocrite. So I need to do this too. And honestly, it's been the best thing ever because I was wrong. I was just wrong. People everywhere crave this. They want to be inspired. But I've seen particularly in all of these spaces, a craving for not only being inspired, but having something to do with that inspiration as well. You know, and that's where the actions come in. That's where the connection to solutions, the connection to community, to doers, to thinkers comes in.
Do you remember the moment when you stepped out wearing both of those hats?
The moment, no, but a moment, yes. I'll share a very big one for me. I mentioned the United Nations briefly just a second ago. So for many years, I had been a part of what's called some of the, used to be called the major groups, particularly the women's and youth major group, helped draft some policies together, helped do a training for grassroots women to understand how to navigate UN negotiations and things like that. So I had been doing that for many years. And then at some point, we got a request from the Permanent Mission of Germany. We had been working with them on some climate communications to do a creative piece at the United Nations. And they asked, do we know someone that would want to do that? And I just said, you know what? I do. I will. So I developed an installation and performance piece and set up this projection with a film and a performance. And I was like a fossil fuel monster that turned into a regenerative earth goddess lady in the halls of the UN. And it was terrifying. These were the same halls that I had walked in, you know, in a suit, you know, with all my business cards and briefcase many times before. But to be doing that in front of diplomats and delegates, there was happened to be like one of the heads of UN Women walked by, etc. It was absolutely terrifying. And they loved it. At least they told me they loved it. And they wanted more. And they wanted to engage and find new ways. You know, they're like, ah, we're always just talking about papers, you know, and stuff. But to really think more deeply about these issues and be touched, you know, around emotionally around these issues that we deal with every day. Oh, I have new energy. And to me, that's the most exciting thing. One of the most exciting things is to help rejuvenate the people that are doing the work, to not only support them, but to give them a little life, because it's hard. This work is hard. It's depressing. There are a lot of losses. There's a lot of sadness and grief when looking at climate, looking at social justice. So that is one of my vulnerable moments.
Thanks for sharing that. And you talking about how people in these spaces, they need that rejuvenation, from my perspective, is so true. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in these spaces as well, and there is such fatigue. There can be such a jaded aura when you walk into these spaces where it just feels like everyone is just expecting, you know, expecting there to be little to no progress. And it makes me think of what you're talking about, like where we need creative approaches and art that isn't pointing out the problems, right? Like these are the people, and I think it's not just these people that are aware of what the problems are. Like you said, I think most people are aware that there are problems and they understand the specific challenges that we're faced with. But seeing that there are solutions, or that people can be finding solutions in new ways, is so critical. And I wonder if you can speak now, looking specifically at these communities where people are trying to solve problems on the higher level, not so much the grassroots, but in these higher level spaces, if you can speak about any other art experiences you've been a part of that have tried to bring that new solution energy.
Yeah. And before I get to that, I also want to clarify that inspiring people and centering solutions doesn't mean that it's all just hope and love and we can do it. You know, we can also acknowledge the gravity of where we are, the grief, etc. And sometimes there's inspiration in the grief and the pain and the, you know, sharing that side as well. So I do want, you know, particularly having over the past few years worked more and more with so many people from so many cultures. As an American, there's a bit of a stereotype that's true of like, everything's awesome. You know, there's a lot of excitement, a lot of we can do it. And I think there's a really wonderful side of that, but also want to acknowledge that there's a full range of emotions, full range of solutions, and a full range of thinking about what if we don't, you know, it's not just fixing things, but also getting us prepared for what is coming and what we're experiencing now. So that resilience part is very important too. So back to your question, if I remember it, is other examples of kind of art and inspiration in that. I think a big one you mentioned a little bit earlier is our Impact Stories program, which is really a combination of its multimedia storytelling and sharing stories of, again, leaders that often aren't the leaders that are acknowledged in those high-level rooms. It's the women and the youth and non-binary, the people of color, the people from the global south, indigenous, except, you know, long list of people that aren't in the room, that don't have a strong, you know, seat at the table, and to somehow get their voices and their demands there. So the Impact Stories, we do long form interviews. We often work with artists from around the world to commission portraits. And then we create exhibits that we've brought to at least three of the climate negotiations, the UN climate negotiations, to have the delegates see the faces, hear the voices that are not in the hall, that might not be able to be in the hall, and try to get them also to be represented in press, et cetera, so that their work is not only shared at that level and, you know, on an international level, but also that it helps build their status in their own communities and how they're known in terms of their work.
That's fantastic. Have you seen a shift in that area? Like, I just think about what I've seen, which is a little, you know, I haven't been in these spaces a ton. And when I have been, it is on the more creative side. So I feel like I am seeing like a little snippet. What I have seen is that there is still, like, to this day, to this year, it seems like there's still so much tokenization of Indigenous and local and frontline individuals and communities. And I'm curious, from your vantage point, how you've seen that evolution over time.
Not enough of an evolution. Certainly, I think there have been some improvements. There are, you know, doors are open. There's some, in some cases, more engagement, but we have so far to go. And I think many people are aware of just being able to attend an event doesn't mean that you're actually a decision maker. And I think we still see the predominant decision makers, and where power lies is mostly white, mostly global north, is mostly, you know, high income, et cetera. So we have a lot of work to be done on that. And I think that's something that we really need to realize needs to shift in order for us to truly address these issues, that we have so much to learn from Indigenous cultures, from young people. I am bowled over by the amount of young climate leaders. And I feel like I'm learning from them through social media or through when, if we get the chance to work with them every day. I can't keep up. And I love that. I love the number of new voices and new approaches and new views on the world that we see from young people. But it's also not up to them. They haven't created this problem, and it's not fair for us to put it on them as well.
Yeah, I feel the same inspiration. And I'm wondering if we can take it back to the grassroots. I'm speaking about young climate leaders. I saw on your website that you are trying to, amongst your many endeavors, you're trying to make the environment personal. I wonder if you can talk about what it means to make the environment personal.
Sure. That was one of our earliest taglines when we started the Human Impacts Institute. I remember in undergrad when I read some like kind of first environmental philosophy, but it was kind of like really concretized for me in my head, this idea of how much, particularly in Western culture, we see the earth as over there. Nature's over there. I live in a city. Nature's is over there. Or, you know, the planet. Or, oh, that's important. But, you know, there's all these other things. As opposed to, it's actually where we live. It's everything we depend upon. Every single system on this planet, everything that exists relates to the earth and cannot persist without it and without it being functioning and healthy. And so this idea of making the environment personal, I think, is that not having it be environmentalism is this other, and being a part of an environmental movement is an option. And I think a lot of that involves also shifting what our movements look like, because there are a lot of people that still don't feel like this movement is for them, and many for good reason, you know, that it is dominated by certain voices, certain cultures. And I think it's important to acknowledge that, that just because we all need to be taking action doesn't mean we all have to have the same approach to how to do that either. And in fact, the more diversity and the more in there, the better. So I think that's a little bit of my thought of making it personal. That also speaks to the storytelling aspect of our work and the importance of good stories engage people, good stories move people, good stories help people dream. And I think that a good story tends to be one where we can, in some way, we enter into it, whether we see ourselves in it or we get just lost in a place we don't see ourselves, but maybe just want to travel in for a while. Being able to do that with the idea of our environment, our planet, our home, and how we take care of it is just paramount to us actually getting some good stuff done.
Oh, so much. I'm just thinking about little Tara again, as we're talking about stories. And I'm wondering, what kind of stories did you like when you were younger? Do you remember?
Oh, I was a like literary snob at a young age. And I remember like going to the book. I mean, I read a lot, but I remember going to the little book fairs that we used to have book fairs at our public elementary schools and in the DC area. And I'd only select the Newbery Award winners, like, which maybe,
wow,
you know.
Impressive.
Yeah, that, I mean, I don't know why. I don't know what that got into. I think that was kind of like tween Tara. At a young age, I very much felt that I loved animals more than human animals. And that if something happened to an animal in book, I would like sob. And I also remember getting a little bit into science fiction for a little while. And I think that's interesting because I don't read it much now, but I'm intrigued also by cli-fi, climate fiction, which is a new emerging genre, because a lot of that is about dreaming of new worlds and possibilities, and it's exciting.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I ask for many reasons that question. Number one, I mentioned that I'm a new mother, so I'm thinking so much about like what kind of stories am I going to bring to this little human. And also similarly to you, I loved animal stories growing up, like so many of those, and I think that's like at the root of just being an animal lover. And I think from there it's very easy to connect to the environment as well. And it's interesting you bring up the cli-fi and the sci-fi. I recently listened to a podcast that I have not stopped thinking about, from The New Humanitarian. Yeah. Just a generally fantastic podcast. But they had an episode with two sci-fi authors. One of them was Kim Stanley Robinson, who wrote Ministry for the Future, which I haven't read yet. I've been on the waiting list at the library for like, I don't know, like 60 weeks or something. And I can't remember the name of the other author, but both fantastic. And they were talking about just the potential of the sci-fi and the cli-fi and the speculative fiction, whatever you call it, is that we need ways to imagine. And they, I mean, I recommend that everyone listen to this episode. I'll link it in the description. But they talked about a number of examples of how this genre of fiction has actually inspired real world changes in the past. And I've been so obsessed with this podcast episode that I've been exploring speculative fiction programming within the Climate Center. Like, I'm pushing on everyone now. I'm like, we need to do a workshop for humanitarian workers so they can be like envisioning different futures. And so everyone that I work with is like pretty sick of it at this point, but I'm looking forward to the exploration of that space. But like, for me, I mean, I see art, that is one of the greatest potentials of art, is this idea of sparking the imagination, helping people envision something else, you know. And I totally hear you when you were talking about this American like idea of like, everything's going to be amazing and awesome and fantastic and it's all good, you know, like that maybe like over the top optimism. But I do think we can take something from that, you know, like at least like just like something like a little more generative, like where if we'd have none of that, I mean, Rebecca Solnit, I talk about her a lot on this podcast. She, in her book, Hope in the Dark, talked about how despair is a very easy place to be. And that resonated so much. I think because I'm like a very despair-prone person, perhaps. Because I'm not American, actually. I'm from the Czech Republic. And the Czechs, you know, we come from this like very like dark communist past. And there's actually like a lot of like despair like within my like experience within that place and that society. So when she talked about how like despair is like a very easy place to dwell, like it's very difficult to find hope, that resonated a lot. And I wonder if you can speak to like how art can reach people where they're at, depending on like where they're coming from, right? Like it can counter the despair and it can also counter the over-the-top optimism. I'm wondering like what your experience has been like being this young environmentalist who grew into an artist and somebody who's running an organization. Like what has been your journey of drawing ingredients for your own soul from art?
Yeah, well, that's a beautiful question. I mean, I guess I'd start with that. What I would consider, and I'll put in air quotes so you can't see, but good art is authentic art. So I think that's, as an artist, coming for me, I can speak on behalf of myself, coming from my sense of self, the sense of where I am, of all of the emotions that I have, and to really create powerful, transcendent art that touches others. You know, I think when I'm able to communicate what that is for me, that's when other people experience it. But that's the beauty of art also, is they're not going to necessarily get my emotions from the work. It depends on the artwork, of how prescriptive it is or how abstract, etc. But they'll put some of themselves in it as well. And they'll maybe take some of my story and adapt it. That's actually something, as an artist, drives my mom crazy. But I always, when people are like, what is this about? I always ask them to tell me what it's about first. Because if I tell them, they'll be like, oh yeah, that's what it's about. It's what Tara said it was about. She made it. As opposed to them dreaming, you know, and inviting them in. So that's for me, the base of it is to make wonderful art. And if artists want their art to have a specific impact or a specific message, that's where it comes to maybe engaging outside of their own practice with partners to figure out, okay, how do we, if our goal is actually to communicate X, Y, or Z with our art, how do we best do that? How will that be heard? So I think it's this process of listening that's both internal. So really powerful art is going to come from listening to what's going on within us as an artist. A really powerful impact and communication with others is going to be about listening to what they might want, need, or what they hear. So I think that would be the double process on that.
Oh, interesting. Is that like, are both of those things art?
Well, for me, yes. I mean, I don't believe in a stringent definition of it. And I'm really, really interested these days. I know one of the groups that we've invited for this fellowship that I spoke about earlier for young people, all they do is participatory art making, you know, and I know there are a lot of artists that have participatory inclusive practices. And I think that's, of course, it's creative. It's creating together. It's building together. It's inspiring others. So for me, it's definitely art.
I have a very broad definition of art as well. You just got me thinking about authenticity, and I agree with you completely that when authenticity is not a part of my process, I do think that it comes across as like oftentimes just thinking back to some pieces and projects I've done. If there isn't that authenticity piece, I think that the art comes across as like just more decorative, you know, and I do a lot of illustration as well. And so I can see those types of works for sure within my practice. But then thinking about like collaborative, like big, huge collaborative projects, like participatory art projects, or I'm thinking about like theater or film or dance. And I wonder like how authenticity like in groups is captured.
Sure. And I'm going to answer that, but I also want to add, because this is at least as important as authenticity for me and my practice, is vulnerability. I think the more vulnerable we can be in our work, and again, that's defined by ourselves as what vulnerability is. I think it's mixed. It's mixed with this often, you know, being true to self and emotion and vulnerability can be hand in hand. But kind of the more of us we put on the table, the more that helps others open up. It's just like in any conversation with someone, if I'm willing to go to difficult places, that really opens the door for others to do that. And I think that kind of leads to your question a bit in terms of participatory practices and encouraging that. I mean, it's hard. I think that comes back to my own practice where I kind of joked and, you know, half joked about, you know, wanting to be held in my studio by myself. I find it really hard to share when it comes to being collaborative with building a piece of art. You know, I want to collaborate in a gazillion ways with, you know, our projects with HII, sustainability, you know, I have all these, but when it comes to like painting or to developing an installation, I want it all to be like my vision, not a shared vision. And that's a vulnerable space for me. But I would say both I've worked on encouraging myself to be like, okay, that's okay. I can do that. But let me be open sometimes to pushing outside of that comfort zone. You know, in that place I think I want to be, you know, I feel pretty set in wanting to be there. And it's been pretty amazing. You know, this idea of collaborative art and really being open to other people's visions of how a piece could look, what the story can be, etc. It's pretty great. I mean, you really end up building something together and going to a place where, as an artist, I might not have been able to go or thought of going. So I think that's one thing I'd encourage others to think of that kind of pushing outside of our comfort zones.
And taking it somewhere else entirely, I saw also that you're a teacher, Tara, and I'm wondering what you're teaching and how you weave some of these concepts into your coursework and your lectures.
Sure. I haven't done that in a few years now. I mean, I've taught and done workshops and things like that. But in general, I've taught many different subjects at all different ages, everything from art for social change to climate science and policy, you know, kind of my very, I say I'm an expert generalist. So the long list of many experiences and, you know, things that build up the work that I do and we do at the Human Impacts Institute, I've taught on many of those. And I think what I usually bring to the table is just trying to open new ways of thinking, challenging my students to explore outside of what they know, what they're comfortable with, be open to new perspectives on the world and how things are quote unquote supposed to be, because we all have different versions of that. Again, to dream big and to also give who they are. So I think a lot of, particularly in the climate and environmental movement, there have been a lot of boxes. There have been a lot of boxes of this is what you need to do. This is what you need to look like. This is how we need to act. These are the 10 lists of things we need to do and commit to. As opposed to coming back to that idea of, wait a minute, we're talking about our entire planet and all of our social systems here. So there are a lot of entry points. So why can't it be through music? Why can't it be through economics? Why can't it be through advertising? Why can't it be through education? And so I think that comes back to then, no matter what their interest is, there is a way to connect it back, you know, and that doesn't mean they have to become someone else and want to go, you know, take carbon, you know, samples from trees to be a climate person, or that they want to march in the streets. There are a lot of people that that's not for them. But they can still be an activist. They can still be taking climate action. So that's some of what I have hopefully brought to my students in the past and hope to continue to do.
You mentioned dreaming, and that takes us back to something you were talking about at the beginning. How are you dreaming yourself? Like, how are you bringing dreaming into your own life? And I wonder if you can talk about that for yourself and also as a mother, how you bring that space for dreaming into your child's life as well.
Honestly, I get so much energy from our partners and collaborators and participants through our work at the Human Impacts Institute. You know, the meeting yesterday with all of these young people from around the world, even though it's a Zoom, which I know is not the best way to engage, but it's pretty amazing that we can have, you know, people living in indigenous communities in, you know, Brazil, next to people in the Congo, next to people in New York. So that helps me dream and also helps me just feel humbled by people trusting us with their time and with their energy. With our child, we have a 6-year-old daughter. I mean, honestly, just being around kids, they have a fresh perspective on life and our world. And, you know, seeing them laugh and run around and seeing them, you know, say they don't like getting dirty and then getting lost in the ants, you know, pile of ants. I mean, my daughter, very proudly, she adores insects and getting dirty and doing that. But she might not later, and that's okay. But I think that helps me dream about just that, you know, how they come to everything in the world is a first. It's a first. They've never done it before or seen it before. And the joy and excitement and that awe that we talked about a little bit earlier that I know I had as a kid and I sometimes forget about, that's something that helps me dream, you know. And sometimes I'll find myself walking even in my neighborhood and I'll just take a deep breath and I'll say, Tara, stop for a minute and look around. And like, I have a lot of beauty in my life. I'm a very privileged person and I live a very privileged life. And I think it's easy to forget that. It's easy to forget how many people don't have that, both near and far. And with that comes a lot of responsibility to me to make a difference, to have that be possible for more people. So that just stopping and we being like, wait a minute, this is both awe-inspiring, like everything, the blue sky there, the building across the way, the fact that I'm talking with you in Maryland, you know, and seeing you in Maryland on this weird little computer, that's all pretty amazing. And that can help me dream of, there is stuff that doesn't exist now, but we can have a focus of what we need to build needs to be for a better future and not to continue what we have, the trajectory we're going on now. What about you?
What about me? What makes me dream?
Yeah, I'd love to know that. Yeah. I know you're interviewing me, but I'd love to know that.
Oh, no, I'm just, you really did give me goosebumps. And now I'm looking at my sky. And right now, what's helping me dream? I mean, so many things. Honestly, probably like 100 things a day. But right now I have this little pile of books here that I got from my son's bookshelf. And you just like, I just love books so much. And I'm a lifelong book lover. And I wasn't like quite so discerning when I was younger as you were. So I actually had this like point of pride. Like I really think that I believed when I was younger that I had read every book in the local library. And by every book, I mean like every children's book. And I'm sure that wasn't true. But I remember thinking like, oh, like I have mastered this like children's book section. And so I have just been loving, you know, these children's books. They're just so incredible, you know, and they're incredibly inspiring. And you realize that they're like, this one's about Prague, and I mentioned it from the Czech Republic. You know, children's books are written, I really believe, are written by our kindred spirits, you know, for the most part. Like if you think about like who is writing these books, these are people who are dreamers, right? These are people who are envisioning a better world. These are people who are like very much in touch with their inner child. And so yeah. I'm just like loving these books every night. Like I just can't wait for the bedtime stories. And I'm always like trying to like read one more. And my son, he's 8 months old. And sometimes he's just like impatient. He's just like trying to like finish the book. Yeah. I'm like, no, like we have to finish this. This is like, we must treasure this. He has this book right now that he loves. What is called The City Tree. It's about a tree in New York City that gets planted in front of this little child's house. And there's this description that's stuck with me. So I'm right now looking outside of the winter trees that have no leaves. And there's this description in that book about how like in the wintertime, the tree's branches are like paintbrushes in a cup. And every time I read it, I'm just like, oh, that's poetry. You know, it's a children's book and it's just so beautiful. I'll connect it in the description of the podcast. So thank you for asking. Yeah. There's so many things. That actually takes me to my second to last question for you. And that is, Tara, who are three artists that you're really loving?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. I have a very visual memory and I feel like I'm in a phase also, so names are really hard for me to remember. And I also feel like right now I'm very much in the phase of creating and absorbing from those around me as opposed to like searching out others in terms of like looking up new artists, etc. That being a caveat of vulnerability, I will also add that I am always inspired by the artists that submit to our Creative Climate Awards, and those submissions are coming in right now. And it's always just a joy. We have our whole team is invited to review and give their thoughts on all of the applicants. So everything from interns to chief of staff to advisory council are invited to see how the art impacts them. And I find that just the sheer number of artists that care about communicating climate in some way or another through their work is really inspiring to me. So I don't have specific names for you. I'm sorry, but I can come back to you on that and we can put some notes in the chat.
Oh, that would be so nice. You know, even if you're willing to share, like for the description and for, I always publish a little blog post with this. Maybe I can just link to three of your favorite projects that have been a part of the Human Impacts Institute. That would be fantastic.
I would love that.
And then finally, my final question is about homework. And I'm wondering if there's one thing you can advise people to do or look for or make or see?
And I really liked this question when I saw that. Well, I think it's nice to make homework fun so that people will then do it. So I would say find one group in your community that you're really excited about that is doing work on climate in some way. And climate does not have to be in their title or the description of their mission. But it can be a community garden. It can be something that's helping give children access to education. It can be many different ways to engage. I would say connect with them, learn about them, and find a way to be a part of it. I think I'd come back to that idea of give who you are. So have it be something that's something you're going to look forward to doing, that you could bring your kids to do as well, you know, and maybe it's making a mural about climate in your community. So that's a great way to connect with community. It's easy to feel alone in the world in general these days. I think we can be very segmented and have a virtual world and not as connected. And I think in order to come back to a place of empathy and creation and inspiration, we really need to acknowledge how important community is in our lives. And I can speak on behalf of myself. I need to acknowledge how important community is in my life. And I think the same thing goes for climate action, is going out and doing it on our own not only doesn't have as much of an impact, but it's hard to keep going because it is easy to get burned out or to not feel like we're making enough of a difference. So start that climate community. Find that climate community.
I appreciate also that you underscored that climate is not this vague atmospheric thing out there somewhere that we can't really see or touch, but that it touches literally everything in our lives, in our communities, in our surroundings, in our homes. So thank you for that homework. Tara, thank you so much for trusting me with your time. This has been incredibly special for me.
Yeah, it's been wonderful, Rebecca. Thank you so much for having me.
How incredible is Tara? I'm grateful to have had this conversation, and I know that what she shared about not being overly optimistic in climate communication art, that's something that I think a lot about, but I've been thinking about more since this conversation. It's definitely a fine line to walk when you're communicating about something that is just devastating to people and ecosystems and the planet generally, but also knowing that you want to not be turning people off of it. So I'm grateful that we were able to talk about some of those issues. And I hope that maybe some of those pieces made sense for you too, whether you're an artist or someone who is seeking art and stories that make more sense for you and help bring more insight and brightness and hope to your own life and how you navigate these issues wherever you may be. I love her advice about community organizations especially. We all have organizations where we are, whether they're directly related to climate or maybe connected to environment or nature or food issues or education. Like, there are people in our communities that can benefit from support of all kinds. And that was a fantastic reminder. And we haven't had one like that, as far as I can remember, on the podcast from other speakers. So taking that one to heart, for sure. And now I want to share a little bit about what I talked about at the front of the podcast, about the podcast schedule, why it's been so long since there was a last episode and when the next one is coming. The last episode was at the end of 2023. And I've been calibrating myself in this new year to, you know, I wanted to switch a few things up in terms of how I do the research, what kinds of questions are being asked. Also, how I do the art for the podcast episodes. The art is going to be shifting a little bit. I am going to be focusing on portraits of the speakers because I got some feedback about how it's really nice to see a person's face when you're listening to their voice. So I'll have that as well in the upcoming podcast art. And it's just, you know, it's not lost on me that an hour plus of your time is just very precious, right? We all have so little time these days. And our time has always been precious, right? And I want to make sure that I'm putting out really good episodes. And at this point in life, with a new baby and with other work commitments, it just takes a little bit longer. So I hope that you will stick around. I do have a number of interviews scheduled over the next few weeks and months. I'm really excited for every single one of them. I feel like more and more people are willing to speak with me, and I treasure that deeply. I need to make sure that I prepare really carefully for all these upcoming episodes. So I will be updating my new The Heart Gallery Pod Instagram account with information about upcoming episodes. I'm also sharing other artists and creators there who are not connected to specific podcast episodes. So if you're on Instagram, please do look for me there. It's a nice way to be connected between podcasts. And with that, I will just say thank you again for being here with me and Tara for this episode. I also want to say thank you to Samuel Cunningham for his editing, to Cosmo Sheldrake for the podcast music. And finally, there will be three of Tara's art pieces, all paintings, that she has some additional commentary about. I will be sharing those in the accompanying blog post on the podcast website and also on the Instagram account. So please do look for that. And until next time.